Now this is more than a hobby. Give them more like I'm Bobby. This is my team and they got me. Shout out to Billy, we're bonding. We got us 3 cups, mate. I know it ain't too late. We'll turn that 3 into 4 and turn that 4 into 8. So come on, you Irons. It's time, throw on your Claret & Blue and listen up to this rhyme. 112 years, wow. Iconic bowling ground at London Stadium now. Blowing bubbles from the crowd. Let the Premier League know the Irons going for the gold. Scoring 100 plus goals like Paulo Di Canio. So kick it off with the homies known as Brawley and Tony. And keep on blowing those bubbles until they bring us a trophy. I'm forever blowing bubbles and my fortune's always hiding. It's the American West Ham Podcast, y'all best dialing. I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, and I'm forever blowing bubbles and my fortune's always hiding.
Welcome to another episode of the American West Ham Podcast. I'm Tony, one of your co-hosts, 4 wins in a row, coming at you from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. On the other side of the line, we got Brawley in St. Louis. What's up, dude?
How are you, Tony?
Much better now, 4 wins in a row. This makes the podcast fun. So we got a lot of good stuff coming your way. Today, we got an awesome interview with Jonathan Clegg. That'll be coming up first. And then we're going to talk a little bit about Fulham, our little prediction league, some Q&A, the next few games, and finishing off with a quick Watford preview. So let's just kick it right over to that interview.
We have a very special guest for you all today. He's an editor for the Wall Street Journal. He's author of the new book, The Club, and most importantly, a massive West Ham fan. It's John Clegg. Thanks for joining us today, and welcome to the American West Ham Podcast.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Like I said, we really appreciate your time coming on. And the first thing we usually get into with our guests is we kind of are curious why you became a West Ham fan. Now, clearly, with your accent, I don't believe that you were born here in the States. Where are you from, and why did you become a West Ham fan?
I am from Essex in the UK. I only moved over to the States in about 7 years ago, 2012. So I grew up kind of in West Ham's backyard and amongst a whole bunch of West Ham fans there. My brother is a West Ham fan as well, and we grew up supporting the Hammers from the kind of very early days of the Harry Redknapp empire.
I noticed in your the author's note that you said you fell in love with I can't remember the wording that you used, but you fell in love with Harry Redknapp's West Ham. So you were born into it from an early age, it sounds like. And the common theme with most West Ham fans, we're born into it because no one would choose this life of misery that we have. But
that's right.
So it's good that you were born into it.
Actually, my mum and dad are not big football fans, but but they were our local team, and so my brother and I just sort of gravitated towards West Ham.
Yep, you're not going to a glory hunter and going supporting Chelsea or anyone like that, or were you?
No, absolutely not.
Well, that's cool that West Ham were just your local club. Like I said before, I just think it's no one would choose this life of misery. But now the next thing that I wanted to talk to you about. I follow Josh Robinson now on Instagram, and unfortunately, Josh couldn't join us today, so it's just me, Tony, and John for you. But I went on Josh's Instagram story, and for those that don't know, Josh is the co-author of The Club with John. And I saw that you guys were in Boston, I believe, this weekend. You were watching the Premier League Saturday morning, I think it was. So how'd you find yourself in Boston, and what did you think of watching football over here in America with a bunch of American fans?
So we are kind of in the middle of a sort of book tour that we're doing, where we've gone to cities up and down the East Coast to hang out with the supporters clubs in each of the each of those cities, and kind of talk to them about the book, and try and sell a few copies that way. We started out in Philadelphia. We've been to Baltimore, DC. We were up in Boston this weekend hanging with the Boston Spurs fans on Saturday. Okay. And then we were with the Boston Blues, Chelsea fans, and Boston Man United fans, for their game against Liverpool too. So, we did three games through there. And yeah, I mean, it's fun. We've had a great time. It's the sort of thing that, you know, a book tour like that would be difficult to do in the UK, I think, just because the kind of watching, the experience of watching games in a bar like that is just very, very different. The American fans are so, you know, welcoming and, yes. You know, so kind of gracious and pleased to see us. Whereas I think if we went to, I mean, Josh is an Arsenal fan, I support West Ham. If we went to a Tottenham bar in London, we'd probably be lucky to escape, you know, with our lives, let alone, you know, probably have insults hurled at us the entire game as well. So,
yeah.
You know, so it's been great, but I can't deny it. I mean, it is weird being in a bar full of Spurs fans or Chelsea fans, you know, watching their team as a West Ham fan. You know, it's not a natural thing for me to root for Spurs. So, yeah, that was kind of a little difficult, but no, it's been great. We've had a great time.
Yeah, it's very cool. Because kind of one of the next things I wanted to talk to you about was the difference between American and English fans. And I think you kind of summed it up perfectly. Is us over here in America, we don't have like a boiling hatred, like it seems like some of the English fans do. Like you hit the nail on the head there. You would never ever find Man United and Liverpool supporters in the same bar watching the same game at the same time without some kind of just pure chaos happening.
Right,
kicking off.
It's yeah. So I think you hit the nail on the head there. Are there any other major differences between American and English fans that you've come to notice, especially during this tour that you've done?
Yeah. No. I mean, you know. So I will say, you know, when I first moved here, I obviously went to watch games here, and I kind of wrongly like picked out on the kind of differences. Of the way that teams are, you know, the way that fans support their teams here, mm-hmm. as like some kind of, you know, shortcoming, or like mm-hmm. it didn't feel kind of authentic to me because people were like way too nice, and that's not what watching football felt like to me, someone who has sort of grown up, you know, watching it in the UK. But I've kind of since realized that, like, I think what American fans have done is they've kind of cherry picked the best parts of the English, you know, fan experience, but then, like I say, you know, taken away the kind of parts that I find, you know, less enjoyable. So it feels to me like football watching here is a much more kind of enjoyable and happy and kind of joyous experience. Partly because I think so many of the fans are kind of very new to the Premier League. You know, a lot of people we spoke to have kind of been fans not only since 2014 or 2016. So they're still kind of discovering this crazy game. And you know, that makes for a much more kind of enjoyable experience in many respects. So, you know, that's one big difference I found. And then, you know, I'll say the other thing is I'm shocked at how knowledgeable the fans here are. Not just in the way that they like know all the players, but we went to a Chelsea bar in Baltimore, and this is no joke. We walked in, and a Chelsea fan and a Man City fan, and the Chelsea fan was berating the Man City fan about the fact that Yokohama F. Marinos were having such a terrible season in the Japanese J League. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, Man City owns a 20% stake in Yokohama F. Marinos in the Japanese J League, which is such an arcane, random fact to know about Man City, that the fact that this guy was like ripping the Man City fan for the fact they were having such a bad season in the J League, I found hilarious. But I mean, there is no way that you would ever get that in an English pub. I mean, the kind of level of knowledge was, you know, yeah, remarkable. So that was another kind of thing I noticed.
Do you think that the camaraderie is any different from the American fans and the British fans? For example, you know, you go to the pub pre-match before the game in England, and that group of style of hanging out compared to the group of style hanging out in a pub watching on the telly here? Or do you think that they resemble each other?
No, I think they resemble each other pretty well. I think, you know, certainly in all the games, we were with Man U fans yesterday watching the game against Liverpool, and you heard exactly the same songs sang there that you would hear in a pub in Old Trafford. You know, you could have, if you closed your eyes, you know, and maybe sort of muffled your ears slightly so the accent wasn't quite as strong, you could have been in a pub in Manchester.
It's probably louder than the ones in Manchester. I've been to Old Trafford a few times.
Pub in Surrey, I should have said. Yeah.
And for those that don't know what the club is, can you kind of give them a brief overview of what the club is all about? Because obviously Tony and I have got the leisure of reading most of it, but for those that don't know or haven't heard about your book, can you kind of give us a brief rundown of what it's all about?
Yeah, sure. So it's called The Club, and the subtitle is How the English Premier League Became the Wildest, Richest, Most Disruptive Force in Sports. And that is basically what the book is about. It's a kind of how the Premier League became the modern Premier League, this kind of huge global entertainment empire that every week draws, you know, as many TV viewers around the world as the Super Bowl. So, you know, that is a kind of remarkable story for a league that was only formed 25 years ago and was kind of built out of what at the time looked a lot like the kind of ashes of English football. English football in the 1980s, as we all know, was a pretty grim spectacle. Fan violence was rampant. The stadiums and infrastructure around the game was incredibly dangerous, as we saw with the Hillsborough disaster and other tragedies that occurred back then. So, you know, English football was in a pretty dire place. And in the space of 25 years, thanks to a kind of bunch of different factors, you know, the Premier League has become kind of the preeminent 21st century sports league, which is a kind of remarkable story, a business story, a kind of story about England and English society. So that's the story we told. It's kind of, in a way, it's kind of a history of the Premier League, but sort of told through the owners and executive and the boardrooms and executive boxes, and a story of how we got to where we are now.
And like I said before, your co-author is Joshua Robinson, and unfortunately Josh wasn't able to join us today, but I kind of wanted to know, why did you decide Josh was a good fit? Were you guys friends? And what made you guys want to write a book, essentially? I mean, what was the inspiration for you guys to go out and write a book on the history of the Premier League?
Yeah, so Josh is a colleague of mine at the Wall Street Journal. And we have both covered the Premier League for the newspaper for the last 10 years. Actually, funnily enough, I started out covering when Rupert Murdoch bought the Wall Street Journal in 2008. They started covering sports soon afterwards. And I was the first European sports correspondent for the journal. So I was covering the Premier League out there for them. And then in 2012, I moved over here to start covering the NFL. And Josh moved back from the US to London to take my old job. Funny enough, we basically swapped lives because I actually moved into his apartment here in New York, and he moved back to do my old job. And after a couple of years, I then moved into editing at the journal, and I was Josh's editor. So he was writing about the Premier League, I was his editor. And it was kind of out of that that the book was born. He covered what most people know of as the Leicester season, which we know of as the Dimitri Payet season.
He covered
that season, and you know, that kind of was the time when we kind of started having a lot of these thoughts about the Premier League and how it had changed and how it had grown and what made this whole Leicester thing possible, and all these kind of thoughts started crystallizing in our minds. And we thought, well, you know, as the Premier League turns 25, this is a kind of good time to tell this kind of, you know, a sort of snapshot of the league as it reaches 25. And and you know, we were kind of amazed that no one had written this book before, to be honest with you. It's such a kind of amazing story that we were kind of surprised that no one had written it before.
I wanted to jump into the book a little bit here, just to get right into it, because that's what I've consumed myself the last few days. I got my copy on Friday, so it made for some quick reading. But for everybody who's listened to the podcast, I'll tell you what, next thing you know, 2 or 3 hours went by, and I was pretty deep into it. So it was a interesting read. If it's cool with you, I just wanted to go over, ask you a few questions about a few of my favorite stories, and Brawley, I'm sure, has a few too. Is that cool?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to start early in the book. I think the first thing that really jumped out to me, I just thought it was a laugh, the bathroom stories with Arsenal's David Dean?
Yeah, that's right.
And can you go about how that story came about and his personal crusade and how you guys went about writing that portion of the book.
Yeah, it's basically just a look at the kind of 25 years of the Premier League and basically how it became what it is today, which is a kind of global entertainment monster. Every weekend, the Premier League draws kind of bigger audience around the world than the Super Bowl, which is kind of crazy to think about. And even more crazy, you know, as we get into your question, because so much of the formation of the Premier League was led by this kind of small group of English football owners who looked across the Atlantic at the money that the NFL was pulling in from, from TV, and decided that they wanted some of that action too. You know, as we all know, English football in the 1980s was a kind of pretty grim, product, certainly from a TV perspective. Okay. So they were really enamored by what they saw, happening over on this side of the Atlantic. And a big part of that was the fact that David Dean, who was then the Arsenal, owner or vice chairman, he was, but he was the sort of primary shareholder at Arsenal, and Irving Scholar at Tottenham and Martin Edwards at Man U. They all, for various reasons, had found themselves over here watching NFL games, and they were really taken with the kind of family atmosphere and the kind of idea of sport as entertainment rather than, what they saw back home. And for Dean, that really resonated with the bathrooms. He's a guy who likes to have two cups of coffee before kickoff, and so finds himself in need of visiting the bathrooms at halftime. And I mean, for anyone who went to an English football stadium bathroom during the 1980s, the smell probably still lingers in the nostrils. It was like they were vile, rancid places to go. And for him, they kind of epitomized everything that was wrong with English football and everything that was right about the NFL and US sports, which was that, they treated the fans like paying customers. And you can argue that some of the kind of disconnect that has occurred over the last 25 years between the clubs and the fans and the products, the Premier League as a kind of, brand and the supporters in the stadium who kind of sometimes feel left behind. You can argue that sort of started with this kind of idea that they wanted to treat fans like customers. But for Dean, certainly that was a big part of it. It's kind of a hilarious story about how he was, this holy war against the bathrooms that he fought for so long.
Yeah, I got a good kick out of that as well. I believe he went to an NFL game, from my recollection, and just was enamored with all of these things going on. But the one thing that it seemed like it kept going back to was the toilet. So Tony and I both enjoyed that. We both got a good laugh out of that.
So one of the next favorite parts of this book that I enjoyed was the history side of it, because I feel like I am fairly knowledgeable from when I started watching West Ham. But before that, I think it's very difficult to know the history without experience. And I think your book gave it a lot. One of the first things I didn't know was that West Ham won Blackburn the title by beating Manchester United.
Or we drew with them, I believe, right? It was a 1-1 draw.
At Upton Park. Right. Yeah, that's right.
A draw. That's right. A 1-1 draw. Ludek Maklosko was the West Ham goalkeeper back then. He was this giant Czechoslovakian goalkeeper. And he pulled it. He had one of these game of his lives moments where he could just save literally everything that day. I think Andy Cole missed five chances from inside the 6-yard box. And West Ham stopped Man U winning the title. What's funny about that is Steve Bruce was the Manchester United captain that day. Mm-hmm. And he was so furious about how much West Ham celebrated having denied Man U the title, how gleefully all the fans and players reacted at full time, that he held on to that in his black heart for the next 10 years. And I think sort of lauded it over West Ham one time when they were relegated. He was this is payback for that time that you guys celebrated for us winning the title. Steve Bruce, bad guy. But I know it was crazy to think that West Ham had a such a huge role in the title race back then.
And I remember reading in the book that it was Blackburn winning the title was probably one of the worst things. That was the Uncle Jack, right?
Yeah, that's right. Jack Walker was the kind of first of the Premier League I guess, like sugar daddy owners that you get now, you know, like before Abramovich, before like Sheikh Mansour and all those guys, was Jack Walker. He was the steel, you know, owned a big steel firm, you know, local Blackburn kid. And when it came to sell up and retire, I think he sold steel company for a record for a company at the time. So he was one of the wealthiest men in Britain, and just poured a bunch of money into making Blackburn Blackburn title winners. But once he'd done that, he kind of, like, his ambition was basically done. He had kind of really kind of sort of lost interest in spending huge sums of money, and the team really fell away pretty quickly after that.
He was the one, because you said he had the steel company, he was the one who was it Ewood Road that he could lend his own steel for his ground?
That's right. Ewood Park. Yep. That was Blackburn Stadium. And he kind of, you know, yeah, poured a whole bunch of money into kind of redeveloping that with his own steel company, and kind of making that a stadium sort of befitting a Premier League team.
One of the things, as we talk about money, because they won the league that year, but some of the other stories in the book that had money implications just early on, I thought was interesting, was the David Weatherall goal for Bradford.
That's right.
They beat, if I'm correct, if I remember, they beat LFC 1-0, which saved them, keeping them up. But there were so many other implications, because Liverpool didn't have the Champions League, and it knocked Wimbledon down to the second division, and Leeds got into Europe. So I thought it was just crazy how much money goes into these games and some of the stories in your book.
Yeah, exactly. That was a big one. We also you know, talk a bit about the big Chelsea Liverpool game at the end of the 2002-03 season. Yeah, exactly. That game basically stopped Chelsea going bankrupt, put them in the Champions League, and you know, led to Abramovich buying the club. So that game was, like, you know, literally worth billions to Chelsea. But yeah, the Bradford. The funny thing is that David Weatherall goal, which kept Bradford up, survival was like the worst thing that happened to them, basically.
Right.
their owner got these kind of like crazy delusions of grandeur and spent a bunch of money on you know, these kind of overpaid and overrated overseas players, and the whole thing was just a total disaster. The next season they got relegated, and the club sort of plunged into financial turmoil. So
I mean, it almost goes into the fact that, you know, you hear them talk about the EFL Championship playoff games nowadays are worth millions and billions just to get into the club. You know what I mean?
Exactly. The same deal. I remember watching, you know, West Ham against Blackpool the last time we were in the playoff final. And the stakes are so high. I mean, obviously for the club and the money, but even as fans, you kind of watch, like, you know, chomping on your fingernails, because the thought of like another season in a Championship after you've sort of so close to getting promoted is like so brutal. Those one-off games that have like so much, you know, the financial implications that can hang on one game like that are so, you know, just sort of unseen anywhere else in any kind of sports league. And I think that's one of the things that make the Premier League, you know, so popular and such a sort of massive, compelling watch around the world is, you know, that you can get these games that Man U against West Ham on the last day of the season turns into this, you know, pivotal game that can like decide the Championship, or the relegation, you know, implications of the games down the bottom, you know, as we've kind of, as West Ham fans, we've seen too many times for our own good, you know, that these games, you know, can almost be more exciting than the stuff that's happening at the top of the table.
And then, if you don't mind, one last story that I wanted to get into. I'm sure Brawley might have a few, or I know he has some more questions here. But do you mind talking about the Liverpool Chelsea story? A little more about the American military man who gave that speech to those players, saying that they were ready to run through the walls.
Yeah, that's right. So this is like one of the great things about doing a book like this is, you know, we did so many interviews. I think over 100 interviews we did in the end. And, you know, a lot of it was going back and kind of re-reporting these old stories. You know, because people know the kind of broad brushstrokes of Premier League history, we had to really sort of, you know, go back and speak to these people to try and kind of bring some added value to this, because we couldn't just tell the story because people kind of know that. So we found that, like, when you go back and speak to all these people, these sort of strange characters, you know, keep cropping up here and there, and people that you wouldn't expect. And this guy is one of them, this General Charles Krulak, who was a kind of former U.S. Marine commander, and first cropped up, back in 2002-03, the final day of the season. Chelsea were playing Liverpool at home in a game that would decide which of the two teams would qualify for the Champions League. And the club was kind of in financial dire straits at the time, and this guy Trevor Birch was kind of trying to hold the whole thing together. He was a sort of accountant who was in charge of the books at Chelsea, and he brought in this guy Charles Krulak to talk to the team on the eve of the game. And they he gathered the team in this hotel ballroom, because Chelsea, they didn't used to stay in hotels before games back then. The players used to stay home and then come in for the next day. But because the game was so important, they wanted them to have the best kind of possible preparation. They had them stay in a hotel and got this U.S. Marine guy to come speak to them. And Graham Lasseau afterwards was like, I felt like I'd had 30 espressos. I was so fired up for the game afterwards. But of course, they then had to like go to sleep and try and like, you know, calm down, go to sleep, and then wake up the next day feeling refreshed. So it was kind of a botched timing by Chelsea, but they did win the game and qualify for the Champions League. Abramovich bought the team, and Chelsea was kind of transformed. But that wasn't the last the Premier League heard of Krulak, because he kind of reemerged later on as Randy Lerner's right hand man at Aston Villa. Lerner brought him in as well to kind of help as a sort of fan liaison guy, and the general would interact with fans on the message boards, on the Aston Villa message boards. He would go there and sort of leave these like very long rambling sort of missives on the message boards, which he'd always sign Semper Fidelis, the general. kind of strange character who you know you wouldn't expect to crop up in a book about the Premier League, but sort of this kind of recurring character who appeared in the book was kind of a funny story.
Like Tony said, we could go on and on about all these stories that are in the book. I mean, I could have you on here for probably 3 hours and just go on each individual story. We'll save some of that for the readers who I'm sure are going to buy the book after listening to this interview.
Of course.
Now, what I want to move into is, like you said before, you had probably over 100 interviews with just these key figures at all of these Premier League clubs. And I picked out a few of the ones that I was interested in talking to you about. One that I have a personal stake in, I live in St. Louis, so naturally I was a big St. Louis Rams fan. And the owner of that team is Stan Kroenke. And I noticed that you, or Josh, or both of you, I don't know how that worked, got to sit down with him at least for a little while. So, first question I have, did you or Josh meet with Stan Kroenke?
Yeah, we both met Stan Kroenke at he was a guy that we tracked down at the NFL owners meetings.
Okay.
In New York. I don't know if you guys know this. I didn't know until we started reporting the book. But there is a every time the NFL owners meet, there is also a kind of little quorum of the American Premier League owners that happens at the same time.
I did not know that.
Yeah, so Kroenke, the Glazers, John Henry comes down. Actually, Joe Lewis, the owner, who's brilliant, but he lives in a yacht off Barbados. He comes down too. They have this kind of sort of informal meeting of the US owners. Okay. Shad Khan, who owns the Fulham and the Jaguars, is part of that meeting, probably for another 6 months, and then he will go back to being
a manager. Yeah, right.
So that's where we met Stan Kroenke. His nickname is Silent Stan.
Yes.
He's not a guy who likes to talk to the media, and he's actually a really lovely guy to talk to, like, you know, very pleasant guy to talk to off the record, but he just doesn't ever want to say much on the record. So,
well,
you know, we spoke to him.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No. We spoke to him, you know, but a lot of it was sort of on background and off the record, so kind of difficult to give away too much.
I see
what he said, but yeah, he's, you know, he's as you know from, you know, from your experience as a Rams fan. I mean, you know, Stan Kroenke is really a guy who's in the business of amassing sports stadiums rather than sports teams. That's his kind of passion and interest, and he kind of, you know, rightly or wrongly, sees these teams as kind of investments as much as for their infrastructure as for, you know, the team on the field. So a sort of unique guy in that respect.
Yeah, that's certainly what I've gathered from him. I personally, I wouldn't say I tried to track him down in St. Louis, but I would go to where I knew that he was going to be in that area, and I always wanted to kind of just get a glimpse of him, because even in St. Louis, he has this motorcade that follows him around, at least when he was here in St. Louis. I don't know if he does over there. And you couldn't even get near him. I would always want to just ask him a question, or just like I said, just get a visual of him, and I was never able to do that. And so that's why I was so amazed that you were able to actually sit down and talk with him, because, as you said, his nickname is Silent Stan. He doesn't want to talk to anyone, on the record especially, about anything, really. I was just so thoroughly impressed that you were able to sit down and actually talk with him. It's a bummer that most of the stuff you talked about was off the record, because I could go on an hour. So I'm sure our listeners don't really care about the owner of Arsenal and the owner of the LA Rams. But for me personally, I was astounded that you guys were able to actually talk to him.
Yeah, well, you know, so the reason that we were able to get him on the record was simply because he has such huge admiration for Arsene Wenger that he wanted to talk about that. You know, that was one of the few things that he was willing to go on record about. And you know, funnily enough, this was about 6 months before Wenger was forced out of Arsenal. So, you know, you can sort of take it with a pinch of salt, I guess. But no, he sort of wanted to have on record how grateful he was to Wenger for sort of the team through all their years of when they moved into the Emirates. They kind of were, had one hand tied behind their back financially. You know, I don't know, this was something that we found out for the book. I don't know if this was known beforehand, but when they got the loans for building the Emirates Stadium, the banks actually put in a clause that was sort of contingent on the fact that they had to keep Arsene Wenger as manager for the next 5 years, which is crazy.
He was kept as collateral. I was amazed.
He was used as collateral on the loans. I mean, it's crazy to think about, but, you know, and especially when you consider sort of how, you know, divided the fan base was about Wenger at the end of his tenure. But like back in 2005, when they moved into the Emirates, he was, I mean, pretty much the best manager in the world. And kind of incredible. He had opportunities to go elsewhere, to Real Madrid and other clubs, but he stayed at Arsenal. And, you know, I think Kroenke's kind of respect for him and appreciation for that was the reason that he was sort of willing to actually speak to us.
Well, and kind of to tie this back to the West Ham theme, in the book it said one of the reasons he actually ended up letting him go, or at least started to think about finding a replacement, was the protests at the Burnley game last season. It makes sense to me, because that you could see the parallel between the fans getting upset with the ownership. For them, it was about Arsene Wenger and getting Wenger out, the whole Wenger out thing. And I was amazed that one of the reasons that he considered letting him go was because he saw the protests at the London Stadium against Burnley about the pitch invasions and that stuff. So I thought it was very cool that was one of the reasons.
Yeah, I know. It's kind of crazy that I sort of feel like, you know, that game was like the end of the end for Arsene Wenger, and maybe also the end for David Moyes as well, because, you know, he didn't last much longer after that. But
no, he didn't.
But yeah, I know it's sort of, wild to think about. But I guess when the owners see, you know, I think for Kroenke, it was the prospect of empty seats at the stadium, which kind of spooked him and eventually sort of persuaded him that now was the time to get rid.
So we'll move on from Stan Kroenke. the next kind of interview that I wanted to talk to you about. There's so many we could talk about, but the one that we have to talk about on here is, I saw that you met with David Sullivan and David Gold. I was really curious as to how that went for you, being a West Ham fan, and if it changed your views on them. I don't know what your views on them were before, but I kind of just want to get an overall sense of how the meeting with David Gold and David Sullivan went for you, John Clegg, as a West Ham fan.
Yeah, I mean, so I actually, I met with David Gold at his house, and I spoke to David Sullivan on the phone.
Okay.
And I think the first thing I'll say is, you know, I am very grateful to them for doing that. I mean, both of them, you know, spared a lot of time and were willing to talk for hours about West Ham. They, like, whatever you think about them, they are big West Ham fans, and they were, you know, more than happy to talk about West Ham with a journalist they'd never heard of, you know, for a book that was coming out in a different country. But, you know, they were there. And you know, I think it goes to the sort of broader point about the two of them, and David Sullivan especially, is they are very open and transparent as owners. Some may say too open, yes. But but you know, like you know, David Sullivan, if you ask him a question, he will give you a straight answer, which I think can sometimes land him in trouble. But you know, so I think first off, I will say that. I mean, I think maybe it's probably easier to talk about the Sullivan interview. I mean, David Gold is great, but you know, David Sullivan is really the kind of the you know, key kind of decision maker when it comes to West Ham these days. David Gold leaves most of the kind of major decisions to David Sullivan, so he's the one who, until recently anyway, has been kind of in charge of transfers, and he's the one who decides on, you know, the manager and whether the manager is sacked. And obviously he does all this in consultation with David Gold and Karen Brady, but that he's the kind of, you know, the big cheese in that regard. he's an interesting guy to talk to. I'll say I called him at his house, and his, you know, assistant answered the phone and put me on hold, and he had I Am Forever Blowing Bubbles as his hold music, which I appreciated.
That's awesome.
But yeah, but you know, I think so. Maybe it's easier for you guys to sort of ask me questions about you know, talking to him and how that went down.
Well, I totally, like, what I was kind of did talking to him, and like I said, I don't know what views you had on him before, prior to this meeting. I don't know how your feelings were on the move. We could talk about this for hours. I was curious as to if talking to them in person or over the phone changed your views on them as owners of your team, as your club.
So I think the answer is not really. I sort of, you know, and like I say, I really can't express my gratitude enough to the fact that they did speak to us. But I was kind of, I have always been a little wary of the two of them as owners, just because, you know, they've obviously been involved in English football for a long time and have a kind of large track record as owners. And I think in some regards, you can consider them to be very successful, because they have on record wanted to run their teams as a business and not to kind of throw huge amounts of money away. And for most of their time in English football, they have been the owners of Premier League teams. They got Birmingham promoted a bunch of different times. West Ham have been mostly a Premier League team, you know, during their time as owners. But you know, they don't really have much kind of ambition to, or you know, they don't have really a sort of serious plan for how to turn West Ham into, say, a Champions, you know, Champions League team, or a team vying for league titles. So, you know, I don't think that my talking with them sort of changed that view. In fact, I will probably say that it wasn't so much talking to them as talking to guys like Daniel Levy or Ferran Soriano at Manchester City. You kind of realize that there are teams that are just operating on a very different level to West Ham. And part of that is to do with the fact that the big six teams, there's really only six teams that can enter every season without any worry at all about being relevant, you know? At the back of even Everton or Leicester or West Ham, you kind of always had to be prepared for this sort of prospect of relegation. Because if you have a bad start to the season and things kind of snowball, it can go bad. And we've seen many times, you know, we've seen West Ham get relegated. We've seen Newcastle get relegated. It's, you know, it can happen to anyone. So outside of the top six, it's difficult to sort of engage in the kind of long-term strategic thinking that, say, Tottenham or Arsenal or Manchester City can you know, commit to. All of which is a long way of saying that, you know, I sort of think West Ham's ambitions were sort of a lot more limited than I, as a fan, would have. You know, you kind of hope that when you speak to the owners of the team that you support, that they will kind of have a kind of secret plan for cracking the top four,
right?
And you'll be like, oh, this is brilliant. You know, things are going to go great, but I didn't come away with that. You know, I did. You know, so no, it didn't really change that. I will say the one thing is, I didn't realize until I spoke to David Sullivan how close West Ham were to being sold to other bidders back when he bought the team. And to take you back to that kind of era, so David Sullivan and David Gold bought the team from administrators who are kind of appointed when a club is kind of in bankruptcy protection. And this was when the Icelandic owners, Björgólfur Guðmundsson, owned the team. As the Icelandic crash happened, his entire net worth was wiped out overnight almost. And the major shirt sponsor went bankrupt. That was an Icelandic Airway. And West Ham was you know, the holding company that owned West Ham was basically bankrupt. So they appointed the investment bank Rothschilds to organize a sale of the team. Okay. And they basically had three interested parties, which was David Gold and David Sullivan, Tony Fernandez, who now owns Queen's Park Rangers,
QPR,
and a guy called Massimo Cellino, who subsequently bought Leeds and was a total disaster as owner.
Yeah, he was.
Now, the actual sale process that Rothschilds conducted was incredibly shady, really. And they actually, on the night that they sold West Ham to David Sullivan, they kind of bought him into their offices and were also sort of had a sort of separate sales negotiation going with Tony Fernandez, who was on a plane flying in from Malaysia.
Wow.
And right down to the very kind of last few minutes, they didn't know who they were going to sell it to. But David Sullivan was able to get the deal closed. And I mean, when you look at who West Ham could have been owned by, I mean, Tony Fernandez has been kind of pretty much a disaster at Queen's Park Rangers, has like spent lost a whole ton of money on them.
Mm-hmm.
And Massimo Cellino, I mean, you'd only have to ask Leeds fans what he was like. I mean, they kind of, you know, the protests against his ownership. He was banned by the Football League from being an owner a bunch of times, you know, left the team in sort of temporary control of somebody else. So, I mean, things could be a lot worse for West Ham than David Sullivan and David Gold. I will say that.
I was pulling up the book here because something I thought was interesting. And if you, do you mind if I read a quick little part of the book for a second?
No.
On page 295, it says, when it talks about Arsene Wenger's thoughts of the stadium, says Arsene Wenger, aged by his own move to the Emirates Stadium, summed up the hammer stroke of fortune. I say to West Ham, well done. You have won the lottery. You do not need to sweat like I did for long years and fight for every pound. But then later on that page, it talks about what Sullivan said, a quote about the stadium, is we never said it was a perfect stadium, but it was such a good deal. So when we talk about the stadium, and I think that's a really controversial topic for West Ham fans, especially myself, who was lucky enough to go to both. Do you think, your personal view, do you think in the long run it'll work out for West Ham, or do you think it's always going to be a bowl?
I think in the long run it will work out for West Ham. And I say that purely because I think that London, you know, holding company, the sort of taxpayer funded holding company that is in charge of the stadium, has done such a completely incompetent job of managing the sale and lease of the stadium, and in general has just bungled the entire thing from even before the Olympics took place, that I sort of, part of me thinks that somewhere down the line, they are not, you know, the taxpayers, and you know, this is a thing that is only magnified by, you know, Brexit and the kind of financial turmoil that could be headed towards the UK in the years to come anyway. But I just can't believe that they are, that they continue to lose money on that stadium, even though West Ham are in there as, you know, primary leaseholders. It's difficult. Yeah, it's difficult to see how they can kind of reverse that situation. So I think at some point they will just cut their losses and probably sell the stadium to West Ham. I think after, you know, the further we get away from the Olympics, the kind of less of a kind of hot button issue that will be, the less sort of protest there'll be from people. I think they will sell it to West Ham, and I think that may then allow them to, you know, redevelop the stadium in a way that is kind of, you know,
more football specific.
Meaningfully changes it into a better stadium.
Sure.
Or, you know, or even kind of knock down the stadium and build something on that site that is better for football. But that would be my kind of, you know, if I had to sort of guess where this will end up, I can't really envisage a situation where in 97 years time or whatever it is, you know, West Ham is still a kind of tenant at this stadium.
I know you said some of the stuff was off the record. That was one of the things that I wanted to ask you, was did they kind of give any clarity as to what their plan is to, if they have interest in taking the stadium over, or did that subject even get brought up? How did that all go for you?
Yeah, no, I mean, again, you know, David Sullivan is kind of honest to a fault, and he just basically said the deal was too good to not take it, you know, that it was difficult operating in, you know, at Upton Park, with the sort of 34,000 capacity that it was difficult to redevelop there, and that they saw this deal, that they saw a deal to be made for London Stadium. And these guys, this is the thing, they are both deal makers. They are both businessmen who are in the business of, you know, if they see something that they perceive to be a bargain, they are kind of drawn to it like moths to a flame. And so, you know, rather than sort of think about the kind of long-term implications of moving to that, I think they just saw it's a 60,000 seat stadium in the borough of West Ham. Like, why would we not go for this? So, you know, I think that's the, you know, the truth is, I don't think that there was a kind of grand plan of what to do or, you know, to sort of take control of the stadium or anything like that. And I think you can see that from the way that the kind of negotiations since have been so kind of hostile that, you know, they've kind of, they're still, you know, haggling with the owners about, you know, who pays for X and who pays for Y, and can we get the claret, you know, around the side of the pitch and blah, 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 blah. All these things that they have wanted to do that they've kind of then had to argue about and go to court to fight with the owners for. So I think, you know, I think that they simply saw it as a deal that was too good to pass up.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And it also doesn't surprise me that they may have been a little trigger happy and quick to just look at the shiny, flashy things like 60,000 seats, new stadium, cheap price. And it doesn't shock me that they were so quick to make that decision. So, I mean, on one hand, that doesn't surprise me at all. I could go on. Like I said, we don't have that much time left, and I don't want to keep you much longer. I could sit here and talk to you for hours on end, and I actually honestly would like to do this again. And I would love to talk to you more about your book, because I have so many damn questions to ask you. I mean, there's just not enough time. The last person that I kind of wanted to talk to you about with West Ham relevance was, I saw that you guys got to talk to Sam Allardyce, and I wanted to ask you if you got to talk to him about his West Ham days, about his England short stint as England manager. And again, I don't want you to feel like you have to go on forever about it, because if you want to, you're more than welcome to. But I know you're probably dying for us to shut up and get you on with your day. But how was your meeting with Sam Allardyce?
Yeah, I mean, Sam Allardyce is like one of those figures where you sort of, when you come to write a book about the history of the Premier League, he's not kind of, you don't automatically think of him as you know, a kind of key figure in the last 25 years. But then the more you sort of dig into it and think about it, he really has been sort of, you know, one of the kind of principal, you know, actors in the whole, in the history of English football, you know, since 1992. And so he was a guy that we were like, we were super keen to talk to. And we spoke to him. He was Everton manager when we spoke to him.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, he did speak about his time at West Ham, and you know, he kind of looks back. This may surprise you, but he looks back fondly on his time as West Ham manager, and thinks that his achievements there are, you know, up there with you know, some of, you know, any of his other kind of best achievements in football. As much as, you know, the West Ham supporters ready for the end of the Allardyce era when it came around, mm-hmm. I think that as far as he and the owners were concerned, and if you speak to David Sullivan, he also has nothing but good things to say about Sam Allardyce. I think he told me that Sam Allardyce was the best manager he'd worked with in his career, and Sullivan has appointed a lot of managers. So he was actually very great. He loved living in London. He lived in Canary Wharf when he was West Ham manager, which is the kind of financial district of East London. Was a huge, you know, he and his wife, I think, had always lived in the north or the Midlands. So moving to London was a complete culture change for them.
Sure.
But he loved it. I think he found that expectations of the supporters were, you know, sort of started to wear on him.
Sure.
And I think, you know, it's funny, I was just thinking about this the other day. I think when you look at what Jose Mourinho is experiencing at Man U now, I think Allardyce is one of those guys that his sort of shtick was perfect for the Premier League in like 2006 and 2007 and 2008, and the stuff that he was able to do with Bolton was incredible. But I don't think, even if you gave Allardyce a lot of time and a lot of money, I don't think he would be able to get another team functioning like that well. You know, Bolton qualified for Europe, almost qualified for the, you know, would have almost qualified for the Champions League back then. And now I don't think he's capable, in the same way that Mourinho doesn't look like he sort of really knows how to build a team capable of winning the Premier League and the Champions League, you know, now, sort of 15 years after he kind of first emerged. I would question whether Allardyce, you know, is sort of still capable of turning a team into a top six, top eight, you know, regular, which is obviously what David Sullivan, you know, was hoping that he would be able to do at West Ham.
And the last question I have about the book, on the cover, you have a quote from Roger Bennett. And for those that don't know, most American fans probably do know who Roger Bennett is, but he's one of the co-hosts of Men and Blazers. And I kind of wanted to get your opinion on this excerpt. It says, "A rollicking tale, part Great Expectations, part Game of Thrones." I kind of just want you to finish off by telling us what that quote means to you. Do you think that's an accurate description? And why did you guys choose to put that on the cover of your book?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's kind of, it's classic Roger Bennett, you know, material. Yeah. Basically, he has kind of, in a sense, he's kind of summed up the book in, you know, five words or whatever it is. Because, so I think the Great Expectations part kind of flicks at the very humble origins that the Premier League came from, you know, English football back in the 1980s, as we discussed before, and the kind of crazy rise that we've seen in the kind of quarter century since. And then Game of Thrones, as you know, if you listen to Men in Blazers, the way they kind of conceive of the league and the, as these kind of competing empires, mm-hmm. and their fluctuating fortunes, you know, that kind of gets to that part too. So I think when our publisher saw Great Expectations and Game of Thrones, they were like, bing, this goes straight on the cover. But it was kind of a classic Roger Bennett quote, and we're, you know, super grateful. He's been a big advocate of this book, and a big help with this project, so we are super grateful to him.
That's awesome. Well, John, we're not going to take up any more of your time. We'd love to sit here and talk to you for hours, and I'm sure in the near future I'm probably going to be messaging you asking more questions, because this just wasn't long enough for my liking. We'll leave you here. So we'd like to say thank you to John Clegg for coming on the show, and a massive thank you for sending us both a copy. I mean, it's been amazing, and I have to say, I'm not a reader at all. Honestly, I probably haven't read a book start to finish for leisure in about 8 years. But I just massively enjoyed it. If you are a Premier League fan, you will get lost in this book. I promise you. And if you don't have your copy of The Club yet, you can find it online at www.theclubbook.com. Barnes & Noble has it. Amazon has it. But by the way, Amazon, if you're looking to purchase on there, John has said that it might take a little longer. I noticed on the Amazon site that it said there's only one copy left. John, you better be sure to put some more copies on Amazon. and if you don't already, you can follow John on Twitter at Clegg John. So that's at CLEGGJON. John, thank you again so much. I'm sure we'll talk to you in the near future. And listeners, go get your copy of The Club today. Thank you, John.
Thanks so much, guys, and come on, you Irons.
Irons. My G, I see the game different, like I'm watching it through Messi's eyes. Man can't play in the jungle and think I'll let it slide. G, I'm breaking up the play, I think I'm Declan Rice. I might go Miami for like 7 nights.
All right, welcome back now. After that amazing interview, thank you so much again, John, for your time. Really appreciate that. And like we said at the ending of that interview, I can't wait to have him on again in a few weeks' time when we can finish up this book, and hopefully our readers read the book as well, and we can actually have some readers give us some Q&A to talk to John about. But now in this section, we're going to get into our Fulham review. Tony said a 1-1 draw. Brawley said 2-1 win. So who was right and what actually happened? Do you want to start us off?
Yeah, well, we had to do that via text because we didn't record an episode last week. So sorry, guys. Schedules got in the way again. We both live pretty hectic, crazy, busy lives, and we weren't able to record an episode last week. So I was able to pick up a point on you, since I predicted the correct result with the West Ham win, since you predicted a draw. We'll get into the game now. Pretty much my assessment from the get-go is that Fulham were all over us for the first part of the game, and we had Hernandez and Antonio starting up top, which was new and different. I don't know how excited I was for it when I first heard the lineup. I think I would have, if it was personally picking the team, I would have started Carroll up there, but Antonio actually put in a hell of a shift to get into the game. Real early on, Tony, Fabianski makes a 1v1 save to keep it at 0-0. What did you think of that play?
Well, let me put it like this. Our back line was sleeping there, and he ran right through and went 1-on-1 with Fabianski, and Fabianski did well to read it because they wanted to shoot near post, and he went down and made a strong-handed save. And to be completely honest with you, the game would have been completely different if that's how we started. I mean, just like you said, Fulham were all over us, absolutely all over us. I think we came out sluggish. But in the end, Fabianski saved the bacon, essentially, and kept it 0-0, you know? And that is the difference this season. Well, now, in this four-game stretch compared to earlier in the season, is we're making some big stops, and we're actually converting our chances. You know what I mean? When it comes to Snodgrass putting us up 1-0, a nice curler right into the corner, almost similar to last week's game. It's all about taking chances. I feel like we banged on and on some of the other podcasts that we would create all these chances and nobody put them home. So it was nice to go up 1-0 for a change. Any other thoughts? Fulham had a lot of chances. And I think they really dominated the first half of that game.
Yeah, they did, and the stats would probably back that up. It's I think the difference is we have proven, I don't know about proven, but we have goal scorers in our team now, and we're able to actually take our chances, like you said, rather than squandering all these chances. And it's nice that even without Arnautovic, without Lanzini, without some of our key players, that we're able to go in there, and make finish these chances that we've been creating that in the past probably weren't going in. So, and I think that's the difference between us and Fulham. And I think also another difference between us and Fulham is we spent big money on the back line, whereas they did not. They had a St. Louis and Tim Ream starting in goal, or not in goal, at center back. And Hernandez actually out-jumped Tim Ream. Tim Ream's 6'2", and Hernandez is 5-whatever. And Hernandez beats Tim Ream in the air and flicks it on for the second goal for Antonio. So, and I think that's the difference between us, is we spent money in the right areas, whereas they spent a lot of money. But it's just they're not seeing the end product right now, especially not on the defensive side of the ball.
To be fair, I mean, I think they did spend a lot of money on that back line too, because they picked up Alfie Mawson for £20 million.
Yeah.
So we spent about the same on Diop, and then added Balbuena as well. But at the same time, I mean, I think that
we had Fredericks too, but he wasn't playing. Yeah.
Right, but the thing is, I guess now our signings are coming into fruition compared to what they were doing earlier in the season. And I don't even think our signings were playing all that bad. I think that the team was just still coming together, you know what I mean? And then now it's really, I mean, 4 wins in a row, I can't complain. And on top of those 4 wins in a row, we're talking about we've scored 2-plus goals in all 4 of them. I mean, I can't believe that. And 2 clean sheets. So things are starting to go our way.
Yeah, and I don't see why we can't push on from this and really aim for a strong top-half finish now. I mean, I don't think 7th or 8th is out of the question at this point. Where we sit now in 9th, I don't think going on and finishing the season strong is out of the question, and maybe even making a push for Europe. I don't want to get ahead of myself. I know it's exciting right now, but we have some really good games to get some more points in the next couple games. So we will see. I like the way this team is heading. I like the direction we're heading, and I don't think a man that doesn't get enough credit is Manuel Pellegrini for doing all of this right now. His tactics have been spot on. He's made the changes he needs to. So I think we need to give him a lot of credit.
I'm just glad I got to retweet one of my tweets from earlier in the season when I said, Saturday I tweeted, told you, great result, 3 points, keep it rolling. And what I was quote tweeting was a tweet from September 2nd, 2018 at 4:51 in the afternoon. It says, we are not getting relegated, we are just playing poorly, and it is a mess, sure. But one win takes us off the bottom. Anyone on relegation watch or Avram Grant bullshit going to drive yourself insane only 4 weeks into the season. Now, here we are in December talking about Europe.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. And I was right there with you. I mean, I wasn't panicking whatsoever. But, yeah, some of our fans were quick to jump on the panic train, so... Yeah, you called that one.
I thought that was annoying. But then shout out to Liam Hunter, who is in our group chat that, again, I can't reveal what the name is. However, he tweeted, he shared with us a picture, and it was the Premier League table. If you take out, the first 4 games of the season. And it had us sitting 5th on 24 points, because that's what we're on now. But the only teams above us since that date are Man City on 34, Liverpool 30, Spurs 30, and Arsenal 28, on top of Chelsea, on top of Man United, on top of Everton, and all those teams. So 5th?
That's pretty good company.
Right. So imagine it. I mean, I just like to play the game. Imagine if we could have got 4 points from those first 4 games, which I don't think was too big of an ask, if we could have beat Bournemouth and ended up taking that draw at home against Wolves. Oh, man, we'd be sitting on 28 points.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I totally agree.
Anyway, let's go into the second goal real quick. Shout out to Hernandez again. Another great game. I thought he played very well. He had a nice cross. Wouldn't expect Hernandez's aerial game to be the game changer. However, he had a nice flick on, and Antonio slots it home through the goalkeeper's legs, 2-0. So
I believe that's Hernandez's first assist for the club as well.
Yeah, it is that. And then also all his goals were inside the 18. Again, I wouldn't say that we didn't deserve it, But I just think we took our chances, which is, again, something I'm not used to saying. You know, every game it feels like we're going on about how we're wasting them. But
yeah,
that's the difference. When you start winning games and you're taking chances, that's how it has to be. You can give up 50 if you do well and the other team doesn't take those chances.
Totally agree. And the next few games we have coming, well, we finished with a 2-0 win, which was massive. We kept a clean sheet, like you said. And then the next few games we have coming up, we have Watford at home this Saturday. Then we have Southampton away midweek. We come back at the weekend for Burnley away and then Brighton at home. There's a real strong chance. I'm not saying it's going to happen, but there's a real strong chance to win another four games in a row there. Full discrepancy, we are West Ham United. I know that stuff never goes to plan, but I don't see any reason why we can't take it to at least three of those four games to get three wins. Tony, I don't know what you think on our points total for these next four games. What do you think? Do you think we can win all four?
No, I don't think we can win all four. No, I take that back. I think we can win all four. I don't think it's realistic to think we will win all four. My goal, looking at it, I don't think that we beat Watford. I think we can draw them. I think we can beat Southampton. Burnley away kind of concerns me. I think that they might have a set up shop pretty tight. But Brighton at home, I think we can get a result. So, I mean, I'm looking at here six, maybe 7 points. I'd be happy with seven. Two wins, a draw, and a loss.
Following the Brighton home game, we have Birmingham in the Cup, which is another game we probably should be winning too. So, I mean, things are looking up for us. We have eight games in a row of potentially winnable games. So it's exciting. It's exciting time to be a West Ham fan. We're sitting ninth now. We're 2 points off seventh and sixth place. And Europe could fall to seventh depending on the Cup winners. So, I mean, there's a chance for us to really kick on now and build something and really get Pellegrini's first season to finish a massively successful season.
Yeah, I think the concerning thing for me is I don't want to get my hopes up.
Yeah.
But just the way we've been playing. I mean, we've been strong defensively. You know, we're scoring goals. I mean, and then once we get some depth back for this heavy rotation of fixtures in the winter Christmas time, I mean, I don't see why we couldn't push on. I really don't. I don't want to get too excited and start thinking that Europe is a given.
No, I don't blame you.
But it's funny enough is I don't want to say that I'm confident, but you and I at the beginning of the season both predict West Ham to finish eighth.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't see why you couldn't get a little bit excited to see where we're at now. And I just think the team is finally clicking.
Sure. So now, I guess, if you don't have anything to add, we can move straight into the Q&A. We got a few responses to our Q&A section this week. And the first one that we have here is from Adam Smith. I believe he is with the Green Street Hammers.
Yep.
And he says, I was all in for moving Antonio and Chicharito 2 weeks ago. Now I can't see us doing either. Who are the most likely players to be moved on? He says he would sell Oxford and Obiang, and his Twitter handle is at Adam Smith with two I's. So, Tony, firstly, do you want us to sell either Antonio or Chicharito? And second, who are the players that you would move out this window?
Oof. Okay, so the first person I would – well, I want to respond to the Antonio and Chicharito part first. Sure. I think that we need both of those players right now that they're finally hitting some form and may feel comfortable. I don't – if Chicharito wants to stay – and I've always said this thing about football. It's funny, after we just listened to this whole interview and I started reading this book, The Club, that you've heard earlier in the podcast, you know, everything's about money. But for me, I guess as a fan, it's not about money. I want people on West Ham who want to play for West Ham. And Chicharito has came out and said, hey, he is now finally getting game time. That's all he wanted.
Yeah,
so true. If he's playing well and he's finally getting game time, I'm okay with keeping him. That doesn't bother me. Antonio is finally scoring some goals. If it was me, I think we should cash in now. I think his stock is only rising. I don't think he's a player that we need. I like what he's doing, and I like Antonio personally, but if there's a time to cash in, it's now.
Yeah, I think I agree with you for the most part. Definitely on Hernandez, we should not sell him. As long as he's happy, I said this from day one, if he wants to, ow, I bit my tongue there, ow. If he wants out, I think we should sell him, and I have no problem with him wanting out and us selling him. But now he's playing, I think he's happy. I think he doesn't want to be moved, and I think you have to keep him because he is great depth. At a worst, he is a good player to come off the bench. At his best, he's going to score one in every two games probably, and I'll take that all day long. Antonio, I'm a little differing from you. I actually think we should keep him because we don't have a whole lot of pace coming off the bench, and I think that's where he will come into use a lot. And I probably said in the past that I would sell him on, but now that he's coming into form, I'm probably going to change my tune a little bit and say I want to keep him, mainly as bench pace. I think we should keep him. So
yeah, as but for- at the same time, if I could jump in here, the pace is nice, but I guess my argument is, what's the point of having the pace if you're not doing anything with it? I guess now if he's finding form, sure. But for
that's
me,
my point.
I'd rather bring like Diangana off the bench, who's shown that okay, he might not be as explosive as Antonio, but he's someone who can take a player on and get past a guy. I don't see where the depth chart lands for Antonio when you have Anderson, Diangana, Yarmolenko, then Lanzini will be coming back. Lanzini can play out wide and in the middle. I mean, I think we have a plethora of options. Snodgrass on the outside as well. Antonio's pushing back down for me.
You're limiting him to one position. You forget how versatile he is. Yes, he's right a right back. Winger. Yes, he's a right-sided midfielder. But he played pretty good at right back the other day. If we have an injury crisis at right back, he slides right in there. And if we have an injury crisis at striker, he slides right in there. So I don't think we can understate his versatility in the team. And I think that is what makes him most appealing to me, is his versatility and his ability to come off the bench with pace.
So, if anything, I'll agree on the versatility aspect, because considering our right back situation, Fredericks is out for how long? Extended period of time. And if something happens to 34-year-old Zaba, then we might be in some trouble. So okay.
Yeah. As far as outgoings go, is there anyone that you really want to sell? I think Adam's correct with Oxford, but you almost forget it. He's even still a West Ham player now.
I don't know that
I'm desperate to sell anyone. I do think if Andy Carroll, if someone comes in for a good offer for Andy Carroll, I would probably that would be a guy that I would cash in on.
Yeah, I mean, I can see Andy Carroll leaving. That doesn't bother me. I like Andy Carroll. I think you're a big Andy Carroll fan too. But at this point, I thought it was really interesting. Where did I read it this week? I don't remember. But it had to do with Andy Carroll was upset that people are upset with him for being injured. And I'm like, he's a competitor. You know, he wants to play. It's not like he's excited to be injured. You know, I think a lot of people get angry with him. Maybe, okay, sure, I guess my argument would be his lifestyle choices. Maybe he could take care of his body better, sure. But people who are mad at him for being injured, no, he's a competitor. He wants to get on the field. He wants to play. He wants to bang in goals.
Yeah, you know? People seem like he enjoys being injured. That's the vibe that I like. Like I am 1,000,000% certain that Andy Carroll is just as devastated. He's probably more devastated than anyone on the face of the earth when he gets injured, because he wants to be out there. I know that for a fact. And when I feel terrible for him, yes, he's a footballer. Yes, he gets paid millions upon millions of pounds, but he's a human too. And I've never been one to dehumanize athletes. Like I don't yell at opposing players. I'm just not that guy. And when I see people do that, it annoys me. And I feel bad for players like that when they get injured all the time. They definitely don't want to. I know that for a fact. But we'll move on here. My dad sent a question to our DMs that I'm going to address real quick.
Okay, Papa Brawley sliding in the DMs. Yep. Read it
Papa
out.
Papa Darvin says his Twitter handle's at RussDar40, and his question is, with all the stick the board got last year, is it time to give them due credit? Did the protest last year spur the board on, or do you think they had a plan in mind? Once safety was guaranteed, So what do you think? Do they deserve credit now that we're flying high in ninth place?
Yeah, I'm glad I got a chance to answer this question, because David Gold put out a tweet today. He retweeted somebody saying, thank you guys for making West Ham enjoyable again and giving us something to be happy about. And then somebody else, of course, somebody has to go negative, retweeted and say, don't take credit for it. We should be thanking the fans who protested and put you in a position and forced your hand to do so. Mm-hmm. And then I'm like, I'm 50-50 there, because I do agree, you know. I mean, I think they should take credit for finally doing something right. But at the same time, I don't think that they were pushed into finally making this move. I think we talked about on previous podcast that if they were open and honest from the get-go, if they would have told me, hey, we're going to make this move, and it's going to take 3 or 4 years, but we'll eventually get it together, and my expectations weren't so high, then sure, yeah, I would have been fine. I think my annoyance came with the fact that it felt like they were saying that it was going to be immediate results. Whether they actually said it or not, no, but the innuendo I took from it that we were expecting results from the get-go. How about you?
I'm in the camp that they deserve a lot of credit. And the major thing is they put in 100 plus million of their own money to bring in all of these new players. And that's not to even include Manuel Pellegrini. I think he's the biggest addition out of all of them. I think they deserve a massive amount of credit. And you and I were both very critical of them at this stage last season, for good reason. And I do think, I really genuinely do believe that, and we even talked to Sean Whetstone on this podcast, and he said in January there was a deal done under the table for Manuel Pellegrini. So that means David Gold and Sullivan did not want to give David Moyes any of their money to go and spend in the transfer market.
So they had a plan.
I do believe that there was a plan in place, and from we have very good sources on this, someone very close to the situation. So I do think that there was a plan, and I now can look back and say, I can see why they would do that. They don't want to give a lame duck manager money to spend. So I see that. Do you want to read off the next question? Yeah, or do you want me to keep going?
Next question is Wally World, and that's at 999 Wally, W-A-L-L-Y, World. And the question was finally a simple one. Will Kina score a goal for Watford against us next week? Uh-huh. What are your thoughts on
Dominguez? It's hard to predict.
Dominguez?
Dominguez. Is it Quina or Kina? I don't know how to pronounce it.
Kina.
That's probably
correct Quinoa.
Yeah, it's probably the correct pronunciation.
That vegan stuff.
Them over there in England, they tend to mispronounce a lot of names.
Chikorito. If I hear one more fucking podcast that says Chikorito, I swear to God, I'm going to throw my iPhone through the wall.
Or Jose or Rondon when it's really Rondon and like that sort of stuff. It cracks me up.
We speak American.
It would be typical West Ham if he does go and score against us. I don't think he will. I don't even know if he'll start. He did score a wonder goal, his
off
first
bench,
ever Premier
though.
League goal. I'm going to go no. I don't think he's going to score against us. What do you think?
I think it depends on the game scenario. I mean, if we're down 2-0 and they bring him one and we've just given up, sure, why not 3-0 Watford? But go ahead.
Do you think that West Ham will regret selling him?
No. I don't, because and you could always say that you take a L, and sure, if he turns out to be a great player, but I think if you didn't sell him, then it wouldn't have made way for Diangana. Who's to say that he wouldn't have gotten the opportunity? Or same with, I mean, look at injuries. It was supposed to be when on X's pod. It was supposed to be Nathan Holland who was going to feature in that game in the cup. But Diangana came through because Holland got injured, and then next thing you know, he showed out and kept getting more opportunities to play.
The only thing I will say is Pellegrini clearly likes the youth and will give them a chance. I'm not, that situation very well could be possible where Quina takes Diangana's spot in the lineup and we don't see Diangana. That could happen.
So answer the question. Do you think yes or no, do you think that we'll regret?
Yeah, I think we will. I think we will regret selling him on because he scores wonder goals at every single tournament competition that he plays in. So I do think for the small fee that we got for him, we will regret not keeping him. But yeah, it is what it is. You got to sell some players too. I get that.
So my question, well, I'm going to branch off this then. If we go into selling another youngster, Rhys Oxford, do you think that if we sell him for 15, 20 million, which who's to say we're even going to get that? I don't know why these high transfer numbers are spit about for a guy who's put Ozo in his pocket and then hasn't played since.
I think the situations are totally, totally, totally different. Oxford has been, from my understanding, has not been the ideal pro. And Quinna had been with the club for a short period of time, and he wanted to go because he didn't think he was going to get. Yeah,
yeah.
And he didn't think he was going to get time to play, so he wanted out, which I totally understand. But Rhys Oxford's been different. He's been pouting, he's been complaining, and he got a big wage that he hasn't put to use yet. And even when he goes on loan, he doesn't set the world on fire there. The places he's gone on loan, so.
Right.
I think the situations are different. I think Rhys Oxford could go on to have an amazing career. Don't get me wrong. But I think he needs to go somewhere else for that to happen.
All right. So then the next question here is from Ian, and that's at Ian Gravett, Gravett. Where do you think Nasri will fit in if he signs? Talk of a signing Perea from Man United on loan. Okay, I haven't seen that, so let's just address the Nasri first.
Yeah, I think as long as we get the old Nasri and he's willing to really go to work and work on his fitness, I think he's a nothing but a good addition, at least depth. I don't like that how much we're going to be paying him when Declan Rice is on peanuts compared to that, but I think he'll be a good addition. What do you think about Nasri?
I'm actually kind of excited for Nasri, even if he's just another creative midfielder to push the team when it comes to practice. I think that's nice to, even if he doesn't get much game time, which I think he would. I think sometimes we're really missing that extra guy who can unlock the defense, that creative touch. Sometimes it's just push it down the line and hope Felipe can cross it into somebody. Or same with Snodgrass. Hoof it down the line and hopefully Snoddy can cut it in and do a curler. So maybe it might help us play up the middle when we need to if teams figure out our style of play going through the outsides. So I think if worst case scenario is just another body in practice that has some creative ability to push the first team. Or he comes in and he actually plays well. Who knows?
Yeah. And the final question we have here is from the Minneapolis Hammers. Twitter handle is at Hammers MPLS. And they kind of piggybacking off of our Antonio conversation. They ask, Antonio has been solid lately. Should we continue taking advantage of his versatility or let him get in form at his best position? Also, what do you think his best position is? So do you think – so I guess he's asking if we should – keep using his versatility or sell him. I think that's what he's getting at. And then what do you think his best position is? We already kind of talked about selling him. You would, I would not. But what do you think his best position is?
Oof. Okay. So, oh goodness me. Is it fair to say his best position is wherever we need him? Because I don't think he has a best position. Sometimes he plays very well on the outside when he can run and cut in. Sometimes he plays well at striker, and sometimes he doesn't. Sometimes he plays well right wing. Sometimes he doesn't. How about the game when he just played right back and he played very well? But there was plenty of times that other season when he played right back and was absolute non-existent. So I think he's just such an inconsistent up and down player that. On his best days, his best position's any of those three. And on his worst day, he's on the bench because he's not good enough.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say right back's definitely not his best position. I think we can rule out right back from his best position. I agree with what you're saying. Like, if we need him at right back and he is capable of having a good game at right back. But I think if we're just ranking his positions where he is best used, right back is not one of those positions. Now that leaves striker and right wing or right midfield, or even you could bundle that into three positions. For me, I think he's performed best when he is at the right wing. So when he's forward, at three forwards, he's on the right side of that the forward group. That's where I've liked him the best, where he's driving at players, running at players. The only problem is when he's out there, he can't find a cross. Usually he's not the best crosser of the ball, which means we can move him into striker, and I think he's really good there sometimes, and he's really bad. It's a really good question. I don't know that I can answer it, though. If I had to pick one, I mean, right wing, I guess, but it's really hard to say. I think it's a terrific question from Minneapolis Hammer there.
We did get one more question. Who snuck in here late about 5 minutes ago. It was Scott, and that's at ScottyBoy183. His account's locked, so if you can't get him, shoot him a request, and we'll see what happens there. But the question is, with the January transfer window fast approaching, is there any hidden gems in the MLS which may be worth signing for West Ham?
Well, I must start by stating I know very little about the MLS. If St. Louis ever gets an MLS team, I will be all on board with the MLS and getting watching all the games and stuff. I will say I know a lot more about USL than I do MLS. That being said,
any hidden USL gems?
There's a couple. Cameron Lancaster, who played at where did he play this season? Louisville, I think. He just left Louisville. He was the Golden Boot winner, and he's getting up there in age, though, so I don't know if he could do a job in the Premier League. As far as hidden gems, no, not really.
I have one.
In the USL or MLS?
Oh, MLS. My bad. You're still in
the MLS. MLS, there's one guy that comes to mind, and that's Joseph Martinez from Atlanta.
Oh,
he's been setting the world on fire. I did watch the MLS Cup final, and he scored again in that game. So Joseph Martinez, maybe. But I will say I don't know. I won't go very deep in the doldrums of MLS. There could be more out there. That's just the biggest name that come to my mind.
I was thinking Miguel Amarion, who is Paraguayan.
Where does he play?
For Atlanta.
Okay.
He's touted moves to come to the Premier League right now. Newcastle is a big spot. However, West Ham has been rumored to be interested in him mm-hmm. as well. And we have that link, both from Paraguay, is the general, Balbuena.
Yeah.
So who knows if he might be coming to West Ham United.
And didn't the Columbus Crew goalie go sign for Man City or something? Is that right?
Zach Steffen, used to play in the Philadelphia Union Academy, has just signed for, I believe, $10 million to go to Manchester City and be a brick on the bench. So sucks to be you. No salt here. Anyway, I don't have anything else for MLS off the top of my head. I mean, I'm a Philadelphia Union fan, and it's been dire lately. So, lately for 10 seasons now. So, nothing much there.
St. Louis FC made the playoffs for the first time in our four-year existence this season, and then we got smoked. We took a red card early in the game against Orange County Blues, and they're not Orange County Blues anymore. They're just Orange County FC. But we got smoked. It wasn't good. But we got the playoffs, so that was cool. So the next thing we need to get into now is our Watford preview, Tony. And I guess we'll do a quick not queef. I was going to say queef.
Yeah, I know that's what you're going to say. God.
We'll go and do a quick preview and prediction for the game. So what are your kind of vibes going into the Watford game?
Not queef. sorry.
Just got off track real quick.
Yeah, that got... Okay, yeah, anyway, thoughts on the Watford
game. Disgusting.
They just beat Cardiff 3-2 this weekend, and their last few results right before that was 2-2 against Watford, 2-1 loss against...
2-2 against Watford.
2-2 against Everton. Yeah, you got me all... Everton. Got me all confused over here. 2-1 loss against Man City, 2-0 loss to Leicester City, 3-0 loss to Liverpool, 1-1 draw to Southampton, 1-0 loss to Newcastle. So you can see why I'm going back through, because they had a really rough November. and then started.
They started out on fire.
Yeah, they started off on fire, and now we are tied with them on points. So and ahead of them on goal differential. So it's going to be a pretty even game, equal in the standings, 9th and 10th. And yeah. Let's see. I don't really have anything major. Troy Deeney is a major player. Pereira, Delafeu.
Yeah, Pereira is the big guy. Yeah, Decore is, I think, one of the most underrated players in the league.
Funny enough, just the name, every time I used to play FIFA back in the day, he was always like one of those people who was like a 70 rating and would always grow all the way up to like an 85, is highly touted Will Hughes. Now Will Hughes is, oh my God, I feel old. He's still only 23, but like, feel like he's been a professional for 50 years now.
I hate his like blonde, like almost white beard and hair. I think it looks so weird.
Yeah, it just looks kind of Game of Thrones like. Anyway, this is not a Game of Thrones body hair podcast. This is the Watford preview section. So what are your thoughts on the game? Give me a scoreline prediction and who you expect to shine on this home game on Saturday.
Yeah, my like pregame vibe is kind of like the same as yours. I think they're a solid team. I think they are probably right about in the table where they're going to end up. Maybe a little lower, maybe 11th. But yeah, I mean the players are the guys that you mentioned. Definitely Deeney's a threat up top. He likes to score against us. De La Feu has started to really pick up some form. And like I said, Decore, I'm a big fan of his. And Roberto Pereira, I believe Roberto is his first name. I think he's really, really started the season playing well. And I believe he used to play for Juventus, too. So he's got some quality there. As far as predictions go, we're at home. I think we're going to be buzzing. And I originally was going to pick a draw, but I'm going to go away from that. I'm going to predict a win. It's just a score that I'm trying to struggle with. So I think I'm going to go 2-1. I'm going to go with the 2-1 West Ham victory, and that's 5 in a row. And normally, you know, I'm the pessimist, and this would be definitely the game that I predict a draw. But I'm just getting a vibe about me that says win, so I'm going to go win.
Ah, man. See, this is unfortunate because no one's going to pick up any additional points or lose ground this week because I was thinking 2-1 win as well. I can't pick against us right now. I did last week, and I was pleasantly surprised. I feel like we have to get a draw at some point or lose at some point. But I don't think it's going to be this week. I think that we still stick it out. I think we're a strong side right now. I think we'll have the home crowd behind us. And I think 2-1 is fair. I don't think it'll be hard on Fabianski. I think he deserves plenty of clean sheets. However, 2-1 I think is a great pick. And that's what I had written down here too. So hopefully we're both on 11 points and we are correct. However, we are going to stay even. And right now the standings are 8 for Tony, 8 for Brawley. That's it for Watford for me. Do you have anything else to say on this wonderful evening podcast?
Nope. I hope you guys all enjoyed the interview with John Clegg, because I know Tony and I both massively enjoyed it. Like I honestly could have sat there and picked his brain for hours on it.
I know. I was geeking. If you won't really notice because I have to edit it, but I just jumped right into the questions. Everybody was like, can we talk about the book first? And I'm like, okay, I had so many stories I want to talk about. So I thought it was a great book so far, and I can't wait to finish it off. We're going to have Jonathan back on the podcast in a few weeks or a month's time to give us another recap. And then, Brawley, do you want to take us out? Because I always mess it up.
Yep, you can reach us on Twitter at West Ham Pod USA, and if you'd like to send us an email, you can send us an email to AmericanWestHamPod@gmail.com. Also, please, please, please go on and iTunes and give us a 5-star review. We've gotten a few of those here lately, so we really appreciate it. Thank you guys so much. And so for this week, we are signing off. Tony in Harrisburg, me, Brawley in St. Louis. We are saying goodbye for the week. Peace.
Peace. Ours.
This is more than a hobby. Give them more like I'm Bobby. This is my team and they got me. Shout
Shout out to Billy, we're bonding. We got us 3 cups, mate. I know it ain't too late. We'll turn that 3 into 4 and turn that 4 into 8. So come on, you Irons. It's time, throw on your claret and blue and listen up to this rhyme. 112 years, wow. Iconic bowling ground at London Stadium now. Blowing bubbles from the crowd, let the Premier League know. The Irons going for the gold, scoring 100 plus goals like Paolo Di Canio. So kick it off with the homies, known as Brawley and Tony, and keep on blowing those bubbles until they bring us a trophy. I'm forever blowing bubbles, and my fortune's always hiding. It's the American West Ham podcast, y'all best dialing. I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, and I'm forever blowing bubbles, and my fortune's always hiding. It's the American West Ham podcast, y'all best dialing. I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, I'm forever blowing bubbles, hey. I believe it, I know that we're winning. I've been here since the very beginning. Yeah. Dreaming of the gold medal, we're lifting. Set it up like we're penalty kicking. 57,000 people packed. Hear the fans shout from the back. Take the ball and then we all attack. Make opponents feel the hammer crack. Wild nights, highlights, stats. Tony got you covered on that. Brawley got the stories and the facts. Together everything is down packed. 3-time gold winners, but now it's time to get another cup. West Ham fans stand up. West Ham fans stand up. I'm forever blowing bubbles. And my fortune's always hiding. It's the American West Ham podcast. Y'all best dialing. I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm forever blowing bubbles. And I'm forever blowing bubbles. And my fortune's always hiding. It's the American West Ham podcast. Y'all best dialing. I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm forever blowing bubbles. I'm forever blowing bubbles. Hey.
Big wins, big games, big moments, big rewards. Absolutely. Disappointment. All season, promotion demanded by West Ham. On a sunny afternoon in May at Wembley, promotion to the Premier League has been delivered. Ricardo Bassey, one of the January arrivals, with the biggest goal he will have ever scored. And West Ham, Wembley winners again for the first time since 1980, but more significantly, back in the Premier League.